You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt and welcome to Bookworm. Today I'm very happy to have with me in the studio John Mortimer, the author most recently of Dunster, but most of you know him as the author of all of the Rumpole books, the inspiration for the PBS television series, the author as well of the bestsellers Titmus Regained and its preceding volume Paradise Postponed, Summer's Lease, many books. In addition to the wonderful autobiography Clinging to the Wreckage, Dunster is published by Viking, and I wanted to, you know, as you all know, this show is about writing, and I wanted particularly to talk to John Mortimer because it seems to me that he is the example par excellence of the man who knows how to structure a plot. His books combine the cunning of the best Sherlock Holmes mysteries in their compactness as well, the absolute frivolity and joy of P.G. Woodhouse, who seems to be able to make his concoctions so simply, at the drop of a hat, and make complexity seem a dream, and of course the great artificer of them all, Georges Feydeau, whose French farces Mr. Mortimer has published. How do you go about structuring a story?
Well, first of all, I do think plots are very important. And they've really gone rather out of fashion. I think most of the highly acclaimed sort of prize-winning novels have given up plots, really. They have given them up for the sake of poetic writing. But I think it's very important for a reader to be led through a story, and a plot is what makes you turn the page. And whatever brilliant things are on the page, you need to turn it on to look at the next one. I think if you take a book like Bleak House by Dickens, every page is wonderful, and there's so many wonderful things in it, but it needs a story to keep you going. So therefore, I do have to think of plots, and I don't find it at all easy. There's a story about a writer who had written on his tombstone a plot at last, you know, which is how you feel. They are very difficult. How you set about it is rather mysterious in a way. I think that I first of all think of a kind of a theme for a book. I mean, something that I want to say, and a direction which I'm going, and a character, and then another character to be in opposition and just to create some sort of drama. But I think then the great thing is to start writing. I mean, I don't ever write a synopsis or a shape or even any sort of skeleton until I've started writing and got these people living. And then, of course, there can come the wonderful moment when these people actually start doing things for themselves. But I don't usually write down what the story is going to be until I've got about halfway through it.
Really? Because I'm thinking in particular of the almost miraculous dovetailing of event and event until the whole seems a kind of giddy, teetering structure, yeah, where you read for the mere enjoyment to see how it will turn out. And of those springs and balances, you seem expert.
Yes, but it comes in a kind of strangely subconscious way. I mean, you write something and you don't know what's going to come of it, and then you find that it becomes incredibly useful, you know, and you can use it again and again, and it'll lead to a course of events which are going to pay off marvellously. I was very encouraged. You talked about Feydeau, and of course Feydeau was the master constructor, and all those farces are constructed like wonderful engineering masterpieces. And you would think that he would have worked it out in very great detail before he started writing, but not at all. I mean, what he said about his writing was that he started off, he had got no idea what was going to happen. He brought on a character, he brought another character. And then out of those characters came the story. And I think, well, that's anyway the only way that I can think of to work. And I think Anthony Burgess said something about writing pulls down writing. I mean, the act of writing
Yes.
Create stories, really.
Well, let's take, for instance, and it's one that's precious to me, because I had been given a book of farces called Let's Get a Divorce.
Yes, I had that too. Was it Eric Bentley?
Eric Bentley, yes. Right. And it was, had my first, the first Feydeau play I'd ever read. It was, I believe, Keep an Eye on Emily.
Yeah.
Englished by Noel Coward.
That's
as
right.
Look
I'll
After
keep,
Lulu.
I'll keep talking.
And at one point in that plot, the French prostitute, the courtesan's uncle, is visiting her. He's not meant to know that she is a prostitute, but he's come to suspect it. He has been at pains to intercept a message from one of her clients or lovers, and he is holding the mailing tube, the pneumatique, behind his back when she comes in. He's an uncle visiting from Holland. And she says, "Uncle, what's the difference between you and that mailing canister you have behind your back?" And he pretends not to be holding it, stage business. And then she says, "Uncle, you're a silly Hollander, and that's a hollow cylinder." And your breath is taken away.
That's right.
You know, so many pages of preparation have gone into that explosion.
That's right.
How do this too? Is it done?
I honestly can't tell you. I think it's a mysterious process, and I think it really comes out of creating the people and creating living people. And once you do that, if they're alive, then they will perform. If you take a Rumpo story, I mean, another thing which I've found is that you need a number of plots. It's no good having one plot. An hour of television with one story is rather thin. An hour of television with two stories is a bit better, but all the Rumpos have got three stories. They've got a story which is the crime, a story which is in his chambers with his colleagues cheating and generally bamboozling each other, and the third one is in his private life. And if you make these stories interlock, then you've got a kind of rich pattern of events, but it does mean thinking of three stories. I think that you were very right in what you said in the introduction. I think that the reason for the great popularity of detective writing now and crime writing is that that's the one branch of writing which does still have stories, mm-hmm. and which people need. They need to be told stories, and it's not easy. That's the thing about it. I mean, it really isn't easy. I remember Dunster. I mean, I had almost got to the end of Dunster, and I remember going and sitting out in the garden, thinking, "What am I going to do?" And then suddenly, the idea of the whole reversal of the characters came to me, and I went in and read that as quickly as possible.
I'm talking to John Mortimer, the author most recently of Dunster, which is a novel. Now, one of the critics of the novel suggested, and this is a tricky wicket too, that the war crime around which the novel is constructed is a bit too serious for the equilibrations and wit of the plot. Did you have reservations about that?
Well, not really, because I think there's nothing too serious to make jokes about and nothing too funny to be serious about, really. I do think that life is at its most serious funny, and I do think that at its funniest it's serious. I was brought up with Shakespeare, and the extraordinary thing is not only did Shakespeare write a lot of comedy and do a lot of jokes, but the great tragedies are full of jokes. I mean, Hamlet makes an enormous number of jokes. King Lear makes jokes, and I think that that's what makes them true to life. Strangely enough, when I was talking to lawyers on my way here, we've all agreed that the criminal courts, in which the most serious and the most terrible things are discussed, are the courts where everybody is, in a way, funniest. You know, the criminal courts where they make jokes. The criminal courts are where jokes are made, where even at the most serious moments people laugh. And that's because you couldn't bear that situation unless you did that. I'm sure the doctors come out of the operating theatre even in terrible moments and make jokes. Whereas in commercial courts, when they're just discussing money, they're all very deadly serious and bad. So I do believe in mixing these things.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I had this week an enormous amount to read, And I thought, oh no, there's Dunster looming at the end, and in fact, I'll be seeing John Mortimer live. What will I do? And I sat down to read, and before I knew it, I had read 120 pages, and a second sitting took care of the remainder. Now, when you read, one of the things that interests me is that the combination in what you do of farce and mystery, both of which keep a good deal of information suspended, they're both juggling acts. And in a certain way, the quintessential farce and mystery story is Oedipus Rex. How is it that that need to know makes reading such a hungry act?
Well, it's suspense, isn't it? I mean, you used exactly the right word. Whatever it is, it's suspense that takes you through a book. I mean, even a book like Jane Eyre has got a mystery in it. What goes on in the West Wing? And that is really suspense is the answer to it. Henry James, even the most serious novels have got that great quality. And Portrait of the Portrait of a Lady, you want to know what on earth's going to happen. You keep on.
Who is Madame Merle, and why did she come from Brooklyn?
That's right. The other thing, which I think you said, which is so true, is that any story can be either a farce or a tragedy. I mean, if you take Othello. And a Phaedo farce called Flea in Her Ear. Flea in Her Ear starts, the whole problems start when the husband's braces come through the post and he's left his braces somewhere where he shouldn't have been. And the whole of Othello turns on where the handkerchief was and who had the handkerchief. You could write a farce on the handkerchief lost in Othello, or you could write a tragedy about the braces lost in Flea in Her Ear. All of those are simple situations in which the mystery is and the suspense is what is the explanation of it?
I'm curious whether this is true in England as well as in America. One of the things I've noticed about Americans who are addicted to detective fiction and mystery fiction, crime and thrillers, addicted, I don't mean the connoisseurs or the enthusiasts, but the addicts, is that they seem to be very depressed people. And my theory is that when life has gotten out of control and you stop functioning in your life, you start to like to read books in which everything is cleaned up, that there's an enormous satisfaction when you can't cope with a book that takes care of all of the loose ends. It's like being held like a baby. It's like being rocked and cradled. Do you think that's so?
I think that the whole process of art really is the effort of the artist to make some kind of sense of the chaos of existence. We don't understand the pattern of existence really at all, but we can. The artist, the storyteller, the painter, even the musician can create a pattern of existence and try and make some sense of the chaos of the universe. So I don't think there's. I think that those satisfactions are not only for people with deprived and depressed attitudes. I think that there are perhaps a consolation to everybody or a pleasure to everybody. I think that there's something that Matisse said, and I can't quite find out where it was he said it, but I remember reading it. I'd just been to the great Matisse exhibition in New York.
New York, yes.
And he said that people lead very hard lives. They work very hard. They have many worries. They have many anxieties. And when they get home tired, the real purpose of the artist is to give them pleasure, to give them satisfaction, which I think was a very worthy and quite humble aspiration of art. And if you can do that, the pattern of a picture which creates a pattern on your visual life, or the pattern of a story which creates some sense out of events, I do think that does give pleasure.
I agree with you, and yet I guess the direction I'm trying to go in, perhaps, is that distress longs for resolution. And so a distressed person often, going to the shelf, will pick up a Rumpole and not Crime and Punishment, or not Kafka. Now, Walker Percy, for instance, had the theory that depressed people would do well to read Kafka, that they would identify and feel relieved, that their misery was exteriorized. But I think that people want beautiful forms.
Yes.
When they're depressed, because it gives the feeling of accomplishment and speed that seems to have deserted the life.
Well, I think that may be true, but I think that that's perhaps everybody wants that. I don't think that reading a Rumpo, reading Sherlock Holmes should certainly preclude you from reading Kafka.
No. I won't.
And I also think that what we've been talking about is just as present in Kafka. I mean, the suspense is a great thing in Kafka. You know, what on earth is it all about? Now, at the end, you may say, we're not going to tell you what it's all about, but at least you've lived through that that wanting to know.
Have you ever been tempted in that way, the suspense that is not relieved, the book that comes to no answer?
I haven't really, and I well, I mean, I think I don't think you need to tie up every loose end. I certainly don't think you need to do that. And Paradise Postponed. I mean, the last line of Paradise Postponed was quite a long one, but was it's never too late to, you know, it's never too late to begin. So you don't know what they began at, really. I think what you say is enormously interesting. I think if you take perhaps one of the greatest novelists, who is Tolstoy, that is almost a complete reconstruction of life. I mean, life is it's like living through life to read a novel of Tolstoy, and it isn't necessarily tied up at the end. But again, it does have that movement that keeps you going.
Angus Wilson had been one of my teachers when I was in graduate school, and he used to say that you could put anything into a novel as long as you had suspended enough hooks to hang it from. And in later books of his, like As If by Magic, anything does occur. You think to yourself, my goodness, he's become very free form. You know, it's a very, you know, delightful thing to have a form as capacious and capricious as novels are.
Oh, it's a wonderful form to write, and You can vary the amount of tension or the amount of suspense or whatever so much in a novel. You know, you can take a great novel like War and Peace. There are times when it's almost boring because life is, but other times when it's enormously exciting. And the other thing I think about the novel is the work which is required of the reader, because I write drama and I write prose fiction. In prose fiction, there's nothing between you and the reader. There's no actors, there's no directors, there's no sounds of aeroplanes, no hysterical people and all that. But you require them to do so much work. If I write a beautiful girl in a television, an actress appears, and that may be a girl that appeals to the audience and maybe one they don't like at all. But if I write about a beautiful girl in Dunster, for instance, the girl that both the hero and both the two men marry, then the reader has to create his own beautiful girl, and it's a kind of joint creativity between the novelist and the reader, I think.
Well, the beautiful girl in Dunster is inflected by the fact that while she rides the horses, we also have to be able to imagine her as playing Ophelia. and I keep thinking of this sort of drowsy and somniferous horsewoman, a very odd mixture.
I don't know whether Ophelia rode horses. I suppose she probably did.
Well, I suspect at the time that we knew her, horses were very far from her equestrian passions were in the past. tell me, at what point do you think, I imagine that this is entirely intuitive, but when has the structure of coincidence become too weighted? Is there a point at which you intrinsically know that one more improbable turn will tighten the thing and destroy it?
Yes, I mean, I think the tolerance of the reader for coincidence is... has got its limits. But, I mean, life is... I think that the whole process of life is so strange. And if I think of the real cases that I did in court, if I just put some of them down literally in a rumpole, everyone would say, you know, it's ridiculous. It is all pure invention. And think of the cases, and I think of coincidences in life which are extraordinary. I mean, even on this tour, I was with someone in a radio station just like this, and they looked down on a pile of papers in the room next door, and the first thing they saw was the telephone number of someone who they, some ancient lover known in England. Well, now, put that in a novel, the audience would go right off you. But those are the strange things that happen.
I'm curious, do you like J.B. Priestley?
Yes. I mean, I knew J.B. Priestley, and I think he's very English and very good at writing about England. Yeah.
Well, I was wondering, because, you know, here in Dunster, the characters, or at least the main character, but actually a good number of the characters have either participated or refused to participate in amateur theatricals.
Right.
And since, you know, that I guess the first book that I knew that gave me that sense of the theater world was Good Companions.
Isn't that good, yeah.
You know, it's terrific.
And of course, he came on a direct line from Dickens,
yes,
anyway, previously. I think one of the things also that I'm trying to say about that theatrical side of Progmire's character in Dunster is that something which I used to feel in court a lot, that I spent a day in court and everybody was dressed up and everybody was playing parts and everyone was pretending to be something they weren't really. You know, the judges were pretending to be judges and the barristers pretending to be very respectful. And even the criminals were pretending to be sort of appealing Cockney characters. And go out of that, and I used to go from there to a rehearsal room where a bunch of actors and actresses were trying to rehearse a play that perhaps I'd written. And it seemed to be going out of the world of make-believe in the law courts into the world of truth-telling in the in the theatre world. And there's something about Progmire's attachment to the theatre, which in a way is more truth-telling than Dunster's attachment to, you know, investigative journalism and digging out the truth and so on.
It's funny, you know, I remember reading a book. It was on Edward Lear and Lewis Carroll. And the critic, Elizabeth Sewell, commented that while many people think of Carroll and Lear as nonsense writers, they are actually writers who, by virtue of applying invisible logic, arrive at nonsense, not through the dream process, not through a surreal process, not through a nonsense process, but as the end product of logic, which seems to me to be what both farce and mystery is about, straining logic to the point that it gives you something quite bizarre.
Yes. I think that's true. Something bizarre, but something also which is very satisfying.
Yes.
Deeply satisfies some need in ourselves for the final explanation, which I suppose is going back to what you say. I mean, you know, at its most basic and in a way at its most boring, it's when Hercule Poirot calls everyone into the library and says, this is what happened. And in life, nobody ever calls us into God doesn't bother to call us into the library and tell us what the story was, really.
Well, I often think about, you know, making the obvious strange or making the strange obvious. I think, for instance, in Anthony Burgess's novel M.F., at some point the narrator of that novel, a man named Miles, is kidnapped by circus dwarves and a strange bird lady, tied up, and he's brought to the big top, and he announces to the reader, it was like being taken to the circus.
That's wonderful.
And you just feel,
that's
what pleasure to,
yeah,
you know,
to get that, yeah.
you can tell that I'm really a sucker for this kind of invention.
And I think that you get that in Chesterton's, I mean, in those detail, Father Brown stories, that wonderful sort of lurid highlighting of ordinary life, which is, I find, very effective.
I'm curious, have you ever been able, you know, people are always, I love Chesterton, but I love, as well as the Father Brown stories, his Lives of the Saints.
Yeah.
As particularly his piece on St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah.
Have you ever been able to connect the impulse to mystery writing with his clerisy, you know, with his religious aspects? Is there some relation between sainthood and detection?
Well, I mean, I think that Father Brown is very. There's a lot of religion. There's a lot of religious thought in certainly in the detective stories. There's something in a Father Brown story. I can't just remember what the quotation is, which appears in Brideshead Revisited, which is about the jerk on the string. However far you go away, however far you stray, or there's always a jerk on the string, and that's God, which is what they say about Sebastian in Brideshead Revisited.
Isn't that in that monologue, as the father is dying,
I think it
happy
is.
Today, yes. unhappy today? That's so beautiful.
Yes, I think it is. So they are very... And there also is, in the great detective stories, the great detectives are always the supremely good... They're good characters, aren't they? They're good men, which there are very few... Good men left in fiction, but I mean Philip Marlowe, Father Brown, Inspector Wexford of Ruth Randall, are figures of goodness, the good man in an alien world.
I would think as well, now that I think of it, it's funny, it hadn't occurred to me before, but questions of guilt and expiation are questions as much of religion as they are of justice.
Yes. Absolutely, but of course, religion contains forgiveness, which is justice probably doesn't necessarily do. And those detectives have that in them. I think they're the heroes of fiction.
I thank you very much for joining us. This has been a great delight for me, and I please pardon me for the strenuous runaround here.
No, I really enjoyed it. It was a most interesting and fascinating conversation.
I've been talking to John Mortimer, the author most recently of Dunster and of all of the Rumpole books and a couple of national bestsellers, Paradise Postponed and Titmouse Regained.
That's right.
I'm so afraid of messing up. And I've been delighted to be talking to him. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.